Hello and welcome back to the MMQB Monday Morning Podcast. I'm Jenny Rentis.
And I'm Connor Orr.
This week, Gary Gramling is out, but he's probable to return for next week's podcast. So it's sort of a reenactment of the Weekside podcast this week. You're stuck with just me and Connor and producer Shelby, of course. But there was a lot of exciting action on this Halloween. I mean, aside from the fact that many players chose to arrive at the stadium in costume, such as Myles Garrett going as the Grim Reaper, a lot of excellent costumes. But the games were also entertaining, Connor. And we're going to start with one of the big upsets of the day, which was the Saints stunning the defending champion Buccaneers 36-27. It seems like the Saints are sort of becoming Brady's Miami Dolphins. He always has this one team in the division that plays him tough, sometimes pulls out wins against Brady that you wouldn't necessarily expect. That was certainly the case here. Jameis Winston leaves with a knee injury in the second quarter, is replaced by Trevor Siemian, but the Saints still pull out the victory. There were three turnovers, two interceptions, and a lost fumble by Tom Brady, and the last interception came after Brady got the ball back with 1:41 to play, trailing by two, which is a situation certainly that any of us would take Tom Brady in, but the result of that was, in fact, a pick six by PJ Williams. So, third regular season win by the Saints against Tom Brady since he joined the division, Connor.
It's interesting, Jenny, and my chaos theory here, as I'm sure everybody would like to know, is that Tom Brady, like the Dolphins when he was at the Patriots, right? He understands the pressures and largely the inconveniences of an undefeated season, right? Tom Brady is capable of going undefeated every year, but he doesn't want to do that. So you always pick a team to kind of be your foible, and then that way you get the guys re-energized at some point during the year. Like, this is all staged, but good for the Saints. It was a nice win for them. But in all seriousness, you can't say enough about Sean Payton as a play caller and an offensive designer. I mean, these quarterbacks go down. He made Jameis Winston efficient for a few weeks. Trevor Siemian comes in and, like, you know, the fullbacks getting involved. I mean, there's just so many different channels and outlets for these passing games. Every quarterback that he ever throws on the field seems ready to play and ready to win. And so it's pretty phenomenal. And, you know, I think just one of those wins that New Orleans obviously kind of puts their foot down here and says, hey, no matter what, I think we're gonna hang around a little bit.
Yeah, and the Saints have been a team that's a little hard to figure out this season. But if you look at the standings, you have the Buccaneers at 6-2 and the Saints at 5-2. I mean, they're right in it. And certainly in the NFC, it's been a conference where teams have been stratifying. There's a small number of very good teams in some divisions. The Packers are running away with the NFC North. The Cardinals and Rams are both, you know, have a hearty lead atop the NFC West. But the Saints keeping things interesting in the NFC South, which is why, Connor, there's a serious conversation to be had. What will the Saints do at quarterback? Sean Payton said after the game that Jameis Winston's knee injury is significant. Now, of course, these things require more testing and more information will certainly come out on Monday. But if Winston's knee injury will keep him out for a period of time, is it possible the Saints look for an upgrade? Could they make a call to somebody like Cam Newton? I mean, Trevor Siemian was an able spot fill-in, but if you're looking at a team that has all of its season ahead of it, will they try to make some kind of move at the quarterback position?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think we've all, based on Cam's comments after he was released by the Patriots, kind of understood that the reason he's not backing someone up right now is because he doesn't want to back anybody up, right? And that's understandable. You're the former MVP of the NFL. I don't think anyone would, have expected any other one-time MVP to back anybody up, especially when they're still in their early 30s. And so I think this presents a great opportunity for him. There are other quarterbacks that look forward to going to New Orleans as sort of that short-term career rehab spot. I mean, we saw what that did for Teddy Bridgewater's career. And so I think it's a match made in heaven. And if you're Sean Payton, who's been inventive enough to use like Taysom Hill the way that he's used Taysom Hill, or even the way that he moved guys around today for Trevor Siemian, I think you could find a niche for Cam Newton right away and then let him develop into the passing game as he develops into it.
Yeah. And you make a great point earlier, you said that Peyton is such a great play caller and he can make offenses work in so many different ways. But, you know, if you're looking at a long-term replacement, if Winston's injury is indeed significant and will keep him out for a while or potentially the rest of the season, then you might want to have a quarterback that can do a little bit more to open up the possibilities further. So that will be an interesting situation to keep an eye on, Connor.
It will. And also, Jenny, to keep an eye on, to take all of our MMQB podcast fans, you go all the way back to the summer when we did our divisional previews, we did our divisional X factors. Who is my divisional X factor in the NFC South? Ian Book, the Saints' fourth round quarterback out of Notre Dame. So I'm just saying, everybody keep your radars up here. I actually nosed around on the Ian Book front a week ago out of curiosity, and the love for him is still very strong in New Orleans. So I'm just saying, keep it in mind.
So really this whole segment was setting up a call out to Connor's X factor. But listen, my X factor, Jordan Brooks, had a big week last week. So it's only natural that Connor would want to mention his X factor. I appreciate that and I respect it. But yeah, Connor, totally unexpected results, at least in my opinion. I wrote in the Sunday Freakout that it was a stunning win. And Mitch Goldich, our editor, said that he didn't think it was stunning. But I think it was pretty stunning, especially because they lose their starting quarterback early in the game and the Saints still come out with a victory, but definitely entertaining and a big win for the Saints to say, hey, we can win a lot of different ways and we can do so against the defending champions.
I love our editor, Mitch Goldich, but, you know, he needs to adjust the brevity, right? I mean, we've done a podcast with Mitch where he talked for 45 minutes about how amazing his metal salad bowl was. And then to not be able to say that this was a stunning victory, I think is just kind of, you know, you're mishmashing the language, you know, you're not playing fair. I agree with you, Jenny. Absolutely stunning.
Thank you, Connor.
Patriots, Chargers.
Okay. This was also a big win for the Patriots. Maybe not stunning because I allegedly picked them in this week's picks. Don't remember picking them, but it appeared as I picked the Patriots, so I'm going to go with it that I saw this coming all along. But this was an interesting game because the Chargers had really been rolling, and then they had that loss to Baltimore. They had the bye week, and this seemed like a logical bounce-back game for them. But instead, the Patriots go into their stadium across the country, never an easy trip to make, and they were able to slow down Justin Herbert. Adrian Phillips, a former Charger himself, had two interceptions, including a pick six of Herbert, and Herbert only had four interceptions in the previous six games, Connor. So he'd been really accurate with the football. He had really excellent chemistry with his receivers. And what really impressed me about the Patriots, the way that they played in this game, I mean, the defense was fantastic. And Mac Jones certainly did enough to win, but the defense was a big story for the game. And the defensive backfield found a lot of ways to disrupt an offense that had been really hard to stop. Adrian Phillips, as I mentioned, was excellent. Miles Bryant, who is kind of your Patriots defender, who is versatile and kind of came out of nowhere, a former undrafted free agent, like very prototypical. He also had an excellent game. So this to me was a big step forward for the Patriots defense. And I think we're seeing a lot of pieces come together. This was a year when, you know, they're transitioning to a rookie quarterback and they just went on a free agent spending spree. Maybe it takes a while for things to come together, but now they move back up to 500 and they're at least keeping things interesting in the AFC East with the Bills.
So I'll actually give myself a pat on the back here, and you as well, Jenny, because we agreed on this in the podcast last week. This was after the Cowboys game and after the Buccaneers game where, you know, this was sort of the peak of the narrative, right, that Belichick had, like, lost his touch and that Tom Brady's down here, you know, doing all this incredible stuff. But I think you and I both saw something different there. We saw a Patriots team that was actually playing really well. You know, this was a team with a rookie quarterback that was dismantled and kind of pieced together just to arrive at this season with a few free agents. And I think that they're coming along. You know, I wrote that after that Dallas game, I would not be surprised if they made a playoff push. And I think that this was a playoff type victory over the Chargers today. And an interesting stat here. So I like next gen stats. That's kind of the NFL's advanced analytics stuff. And they have this like graph after games where they have average receiver separation from a defender. And so the league average is 2.88 yards. Guess how many Chargers receivers were at or above league average? And the answer is really zero. Like Jared Cook was under 2.88. Mike Williams. Keenan Allen was 2.99. So he had an average of like 0.1 yards better than average separation. But they shut down everything that the Chargers did well. And what's curious to me is, so I think that a lot of people thought the Brandon Staley hire was a home run. I think the one thing that caused everybody to pause was the offensive coordinator, right? Because Joe Lombardi had been with the Lions. That was the offensive coordinator who was fired midseason and when Jim Bob Cooter took over a couple of years ago. And then kind of got that offense rolling again. I think that was the one move that kind of made everybody weary. And now 2 or 3 weeks in a row, your offense sort of plays a little ho-hum. It's interesting to see, you know, will Brandon Staley step in there a little bit more, get a little bit firmer of a hand, because he is a coach that gets involved on the offensive side of the ball. Can he tweak things a little bit? But you can't be milquetoast with Justin Herbert. I mean, this was the offensive rookie of the year last year. This is an ascending player. And, you know, as phenomenal as this win was for the Patriots, I think it probably is a little bit alarming for the Chargers, especially after what they did last week.
Yeah, that's a great point, Connor. What is the reset for the Chargers? And I think they were hoping that the bye week would be the reset after the 34-6 loss to the Ravens. But then the Patriots come out with an excellent scheme. And the Patriots, of course, played Herbert well when he was a rookie, but he's come a long way since then. The team has come a long way since then. So this looks like a very different matchup. But I think that stat you mentioned is really interesting because it looked visually like the Patriots secondary was having an excellent game. And obviously there were big plays, but that really puts it into context with numbers. And just to go back to the Patriots for a second, you know, between their two clusters of Super Bowls, there were rebuilding years in New England. It's very normal for teams to have to go through rebuilding years because you win championships, players leave, they get free agent deals elsewhere. But the difference was the Patriots were able to maintain a, you know, 10-win baseline essentially because you have Brady as the quarterback. So over the last year or two, we've seen them go through this rebuilding while also changing the quarterback, which has resulted in different results. Like last year, them missing the playoffs. But I don't know. It kind of seems like things are coming together. And I'm just really interested in the AFC overall. As I mentioned before, there's a cluster of really good teams in the NFC. It seems a little bit more stratified. But in the AFC, pretty much every division is up for grabs, except for the AFC South. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but the Titans are now running away with it. We'll get to that a little bit more later. But setting up to be a pretty entertaining jostling for those 7 AFC playoff spots, Connor.
You mentioned it before, and I mean, I don't want to make this a disservice to the Bills because I do think that they were good last year, and so, you know, sort of that recency bias where it's harder to surprise us. But I think if this Bills team played last year, I think we'd all be blown away. You know, they're throttling teams, they're playing really well. But if I'm, you know, Sean McDermott, I'm kind of looking over my shoulder and I'm not liking what I see here. You know, I don't want Bill Belichick coming up, you know, the rear and maybe threatening a little bit like that. I think that's always something that he's a coach that you can never count out. And I would proudly say that we were among the last true Belichickian people hanging on here and saying, you know, I think this team has got a shot at the playoffs. I don't think that it's over.
I also picked them for the playoffs, Connor.
Great minds.
Steelers Browns.
Okay, this score was a classic Steelers Browns score, 15-10. It turned into a little bit of a slugfest. And the Steelers, we had kind of counted them out earlier this season, but things are coming together a little bit more for them. I think one big reason is the offensive line has been playing together, playing a little bit better together. Najee Harris, his rushing performance was one example of that, 91 yards and a touchdown. Myles Garrett only had one sack. But for the Browns, they're kind of a team that's kind of figuring things out. They've had a lot of injuries, including to their quarterback. So this was one of those pivotal games for both teams. And with the Steelers winning, they made sure they're right in the thick of the AFC North race still.
Yeah, rough game for a team that, you know, full disclosure, thought that they were going to make the Super Bowl. But we all the time knock Ben Roethlisberger for his inability to throw the ball deep and inability to really do anything beyond that 10-yard mark. But I would argue, and the stats back up, like 10-plus, he outplayed Baker Mayfield today. And, you know, Baker Mayfield had that one, you know, that one deep play down the left-hand side. But other than that, was super quiet in terms of anything beyond those screens and those checkdowns, which have just really become kind of the hallmark of the Browns offense right now. And of course, injuries have have to do with that, but there is no vertical aspect to this offense right now, which is, I think, frustrating for Browns fans, because you have, you know, Odell Beckham, you have Jarvis Landry, you're, you know, for years have been waiting to see the kind of the promise of this unit fulfilled. But I don't know exactly what's going on in Cleveland. I mean, obviously it's an accumulation of things. There's injuries there, but you know, give credit to the Steelers. I do think begrudgingly, right, because, you know, Gary is not here, but this is a point that he has made, and I think that I've finally come around to it, that Matt Canada, their offensive coordinator, one of the things that he did well, I mean, you know, and you had reported this, was really kind of formulated that basis for a lot of the, you know, like the Chiefs, the Rams, a lot of this sort of backfield motion, quick game stuff, and we're starting to see that materialize a little bit with Pittsburgh. You know, there was a couple of these really cool, like, hard flip fakes that Ben Roethlisberger was making today that really kind of drew defenders when the run game was going. And so, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's kind of crystallizing a little bit for the Pittsburgh while Cleveland's still trying to figure things out. But it's just a strange time. You know, I think that we're getting further and further away from knowing what the deal is with Baker Mayfield, you know, whether you can make a definitive decision on him or not. And they're just not taking over games offensively at this point.
That's right. And he's playing with this injury to his non-throwing shoulder and did a good job playing through it, but that also complicates the matter of getting a clear answer on him. The one really tough part of this game for the Steelers was Chris Boswell, the kicker, getting hurt on a fake field goal attempt. It was a bold decision by Mike Tomlin to go for the fake at that point in the game, but it basically resulted in the worst possible outcome. Not only did they not score on the fake field goal, but then Chris Boswell, who is about 185 pounds, took a big hit from Browns defensive tackle Jordan Elliott, who's about 303 pounds. Boswell's ruled out for the game with a concussion. So that didn't go quite as planned, but I think it did show that aggressiveness from Mike Tomlin in certain situations. And look, they played the rest of the game without a kicker, and they still came out with a win. So this was a pretty big, you know, point for the Steelers at the season, and for them to go into Cleveland and come out with a win was really key to their season.
They can't, you know, and the Browns have to realize they can't hammer opponents like always. I mean, you know, especially with Kareem Hunt hurt. You know, especially with Baker Mayfield not providing the other end of that equation. And I think that's what they continued to try to do. And Nick Chubb had some openings. He had some nice runs today. But, I mean, nothing that was going to sort of grind the game down like they like to do. And the Boswell hit was just uneasy, you know, to see. I mean, you know, it's even quarterbacks when they get hit from a blind side. Most quarterbacks now are of a certain size. Like, even when Russell Wilson and Baker Mayfield get hit, like, they are thicker, you know, they're like wider and they have like more of a foundation. But the Boswell thing, just to see him afterwards with his helmet off and kind of dazed and stuff, it's like, if you're a kicker, I wonder if you secretly now get that written into your contract. Like, that is never, you're never going to send me out for one of those things. I'm not going to do that. I'm here to kick.
I mean, the visual size mismatch led me to look up, you know, each of their weights, because it was just difficult to watch. And it was interesting that Gene Steratore, the former NFL referee, said on Twitter afterward that it should have actually been a roughing the passer call, because in that situation, Chris Boswell was the passer. And, you know, not that it would make any difference for the injury he sustained, but actually then would have been a penalty that would have given the Steelers a fresh set of downs.
A good ad by Gene Steratore.
Yeah.
Titans, Colts.
Connor, you wrote about this game on our website, so I'm going to turn it over to you quickly. But just to start, this was another feisty division game, went to overtime. The Titans won 34-31, and in doing so, continued to remain atop and further squeeze their hold on the AFC South.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote essentially that the Titans have kind of locked up the AFC South, and you hate to call it that early in the season, but they're 6-2 at this point, and they've got a very difficult stretch of games coming up here with the Rams at Los Angeles and then the New Orleans Saints. But then if you look at the remainder of their schedule after that, like let's say they end up, you know, even if they lose both of those games, they turn out to be 6-4. Then you have the Texans, the Patriots, the Jaguars, the Steelers, the 49ers, the Dolphins, and the Texans again. Both of your games against the Texans. So, I mean, I think that this is a team that just sort of outpaced their opponents. I mean, the rest of this division is bad. And as much as I really wanted this game to be the Carson Wentz sort of redemption solidification game, I think it was setting up that way. But all of a sudden, those late picks just really crushed the Colts. And you know, the Titans have just... I'm just so impressed with the way that they've been able to build this team over the course of a few years. I mean, they have no franchise quarterback. I don't think only one of the offensive linemen that they start was drafted by the current GM. Their best defensive player is a third round pick. Their second best both of their best offensive players are second round picks. And I just think it's such a non-traditional way to build a roster, but it's such a cool thing to see. And what I double like about it is that it does not leave any excuse out there for any GM to say, well, we don't have X, Y, or Z. The Titans had nothing, and they are one of the most dominant teams in the AFC.
You know, Connor, that's a really great point. And I think Mike Vrabel has done an awesome job with this team. And you sort of wonder between Vrabel and John Robinson, the general manager. Okay, yes, the Patriots have had Brady for most of their run of success, but they also have built the team in a non-traditional way. And you do wonder how much of seeing that, you know, has influenced how Vrabel and Robinson have built the team in a good way. A lot of times we see these Patriot outposts that don't work, but there are some similarities, right? You pick a player and you have a clear idea in mind for how you would use them. And draft status doesn't necessarily matter. And, you know, you find ways to win and different game plans that work week to week. So there's been a lot of creativity, and I think that's really impressive. As for the Colts, as you mentioned, there have been a lot of conversation. Wentz is playing well, rounding into form. This is working out. But he had those two backbreaking interceptions, and both were really killer for the team. I mean, the one on the goal line, you thought that that would easily be the worst interception of the game, but then he has the one in overtime that seals the game, and all the Titans have to do at that point is kick a field goal, which in Titans land is never a sure thing, but it was on this day, so.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, right, because it shows how kind of razor thin like a player's narrative, all the things that it can hinge on, because what was arguably kind of the best throw of that game that Carson Wentz made was that 50-50 ball to Michael Pittman to set up overtime when they were down, right? They got the ball 30 seconds left. He escapes pressure. He kind of puts his knuckle on the ground and then launches that thing. That could have easily been intercepted too, you know? And it's not like, and it was caught. So it's a great throw, and it's sort of this Wentzian moment that it kind of draws back to some of those best moments that we saw in 2018 when he was building that MVP caliber season. But he hasn't sort of gotten rid of that strange sort of, I don't know what it is. It's that habit to just throw that befuddling interception. And, you know, I think a lot of those quarterbacks that grow into that franchise mode have shaken it by now in his career. But I know he's had a lot of stops and starts, a lot of injuries, a lot of weird coaching stuff that's gone on with him. But it's just strange that sometimes, you know, he just can't escape that part of his game.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Connor. One thing that stood out to me with the Titans also is they fall into this 14-0 hole in this game that would really be important for their division lead. And it's sort of reminiscent of other spots of their season, right? They lose to the Jets, which, hey, is now becoming the thing for good teams. But they don't get down, right? They fall into a 14-0 hole. Not a big deal. So I think they're a pretty tough team that can create chances and create opportunities. And if something doesn't go right, they could figure it out the next week. So there are a lot of attributes to like, and it really has been impressive. I'm really glad you detailed how the Titans have built this, because it is pretty impressive the way it's worked out.
Yeah. And that was a great point too. When you mentioned the Patriots, I think the Patriots certainly come to mind. The Seahawks come to mind, where it's that constant churn. You know what I mean? There's not there's no solidified positions. And, you know, it seems like every year they draft a guy in the first round and 4 years later he's just discarded and they let him go in free agency. Corey Davis is with the Jets. Adoree Jackson is with the Giants, you know, and they don't care about that kind of stuff. No one on their roster is making more than 7% of the salary cap. I think that's totally fascinating, kind of a neat thing. And so, you know, it's sort of this like, it's what you would strive to do, right? If you were a general manager and like, that's how they taught you how to do it by the books. But of course, everyone's obsessed with the idea of winning on a rookie quarterback's contract or doing all this other stuff. And so, I don't know. It's just an interesting thing, a fun win for the Titans. And they didn't even need Derrick Henry in this one. I think it was like 27 carries for 60 some yards or something like that. It was a pedestrian by Derrick Henry standards game, and they still managed to pull it out.
Cowboys Vikings.
All right, Connor, now on to our Sunday night football game. The Cowboys come away with this one, 20-16 win over Minnesota. Despite sitting Dak Prescott, it was determined during pregame warmups that his calf injury was not yet ready to play on after the bye week. So they start Cooper Rush, who became this, you know, the latest unknown quarterback to be thrust into the national spotlight, and played really well. 300-yard passing game, comes up with the touchdown at the end, the go-ahead touchdown, and the Vikings this time don't have any late-game magic.
Yeah, on a day where Geno Smith got a win, Trevor Siemian, who am I missing? It was a day of backup quarterbacks in the NFL right now. So good for Cooper Rush getting that done. And just gigantic. I mean, any time that you don't have to tax your starting quarterback and put him into any sort of extra risk with the injury issues that he has, that's gigantic. And the Vikings are, even though they're kind of a middling team this year, that's no small task for a quarterback who probably got like 0% of the snaps this week and comes in and does what he does. And it's a typical rookie or that typical backup quarterback win. There were some theatrical sort of weird catches, that Amari Cooper one that bounced off the chest of the opponent and then he caught it again mid-stride and takes it down. But at the end of the day, there were some really good throws. I mean, he made some really good throws, had some help after the catch, but ended up winning it with a touch pass.
Yeah, Connor, the backup quarterback you're forgetting is Mike White, of course, from the Jets. Four. So
yes,
can't leave him out, but yeah, that final touchdown was a great play. I mean, they obviously had a lot of confidence in Rush to throw in that situation. They were somewhat trusting, it seemed, in their play calls. Cooper has the touchdown, and also at the beginning of the drive, Cooper had that ridiculous catch where he bounced, like you said, bounced off a few defenders, lands in his hands. I mean, also kind of incredible that Amari Cooper comes down with the game-winning catch just moments after rolling out his hamstring on the sideline with a yellow softball. Like, if you had taken a freeze frame of the sideline with Amari Cooper rolling out a sore hamstring, Dak Prescott standing there in his warm-ups, not in uniform, you wouldn't think that this was a Cowboys team that was about to win a game. But they improved to 6-1 and extend their lead in the NFC East. They already had a good hold on the division. I mean, sitting Dak Prescott made sense. It's a long season. It's even longer this year. There's more games. So to play the backup and come out with a win is just a tremendous outcome for Dallas.
Yeah, interesting too that, I mean, really, another thing that helped Cooper Rush is they seemed to have that matchup on Cameron Dantzler, and I was surprised that it was such an advantage. You know, he played, you know, sparingly this year, right? 26%, 34% of snaps. I'm just kind of looking down the his stats here. But I thought had an okay season last year, but I was surprised at how kind of honed in they were. You know, he had two picks last year, but how honed in Cooper Rush was able to get on him. And it's just weird that it was two sort of hallmarks that you never see of a Mike Zimmer defense, right? Where a cornerback felt like he was on an island and didn't have help, and there was bad tackling, right? Especially at the end when Ezekiel Elliott on that 3rd and 16 just takes that little swing pass, squeezes in between two defenders, and then muscles himself ahead for a first down. And for all the complaints that people can have about the Vikings being in terrible positions in terms of their field goal kickers or other stuff like that, I mean, this one was kind of on the defense a little bit.
And you know, Connor, if Cooper Rush didn't deliver that game-winning two-minute drive, we would be talking about the penalties from the Cowboy defense on the previous drive that allowed Minnesota to kick a field goal. Three defensive penalties that extended that drive for Minnesota. So it could have been a very different storyline had the unknown backup quarterback not put together the game-winning march.
Yeah, and just some wonderful, you know, I like when like something like this happens and the family happens to be there. Like, so Cooper Rush's family was there. I always enjoy that. And so there's like those like breathless sideline shots of like Cooper Rush's mom, dad, and wife just like freaking out in Cooper Rush jerseys. So good for that. I was very, that was like a neat little thing, but thank God it didn't go to overtime because to be honest, I probably would have fallen asleep on my couch.
It has been a long day. Halloween, full slate of games.
Bengals, Jets.
All right, Connor, we've all been waiting to get to this point of the show because this was the wacky win of the week. Really, nothing makes sense. The Jets only win against good teams. Mike White fills in for Zach Wilson. He becomes just the second quarterback with 400 passing yards in his first NFL start, joining Cam Newton, who we already mentioned in the show. At one point in time, Josh Johnson comes into the game. I mean, this was a Jets team that a week ago got totally blown out by the Patriots, and a Bengals team that a week ago dominated the Ravens in one of the biggest wins for the franchise in recent history. And yet, the Jets come out with a 34-31 win.
Jenny, shades of 2012 Jets where, you know, a quarterback controversy just feels like it's lurking in the background. And all of a sudden we have Mark Sanchez over here and Greg McElroy over here and Tim Tebow over here. And nobody knows what's going to happen next. But we do know that Mike White is starting next week. I think here's what I've said about the Jets all season. They're not going to be a good team, right? They're at best, they're going to win five games this year. But you can judge the relevance, you can judge the ability of Robert Saleh by how tough they hang in games. And, you know, as much as everyone lost their minds over that 50-point game against the Patriots last week, they come back and beat a team that was tied for first place in the AFC East, which is a very good division, or the AFC North, sorry, which is a very good division. And they've had this kind of, like, little thing all year where if you take the Patriots games out, which, again, I mean, you can't. That's something that's happened. But if you remove those games against the coach who hates you the most and is the best coach in NFL history, they've been a tough team. They've played tough. They've played good teams tough all year, despite the fact that this roster is largely threadbare. And so I think you have to give them a lot of credit. They've showed a lot of feistiness this year.
Yeah. I think when you're changing an organization, you're trying to set a new culture, or you have a new head coach in and it's taking the team in a different direction, positive reinforcement is so important. And that's why we always hear teams don't want to have these winless seasons because you get no positive reinforcement for the entire year. So I think this is great for Robert Saleh and his new era is that there are these big wins. And like you said, they're not going to make the playoffs this season. But if you can come out of this season with a few things to hold on to. Now, I'm sure the Jets would prefer that most of those things include the quarterback that they drafted number two overall. So the fact that this was a big performance by Mike White probably wouldn't have been how they had drawn things up. But maybe the backup quarterback position was better than we gave them credit for. We have talked a lot about how they didn't have a veteran backup for Zach Wilson and they didn't have somebody to turn to. But Mike White was sitting there all along. Everyone's underestimating us or underestimating him. And at the very least, Thursday Night Football this week looks a lot more entertaining now. I am excited to see if Mike White is actually good.
I am very excited to see the continuation of the Mike White era. And I'm very excited to see I've always loved like kind of zeroing in on different coach things that happen during a game, but I will say that Robert Saleh's like genuine sideline joy is one of my favorite things. Like when he wins games, he looks just genuinely thrilled about it. Like, you know, like you're a kid on Christmas and you get what you want. And I think there's something like fun and refreshing about that. I don't know. Like his first career when he beat the Titans, like he just hugged a security guard like the guy had just given him $1 million. And I love that. You know, I think that there's like a there's like a whimsical nature to that makes me enjoy that. And he's, I mean, he was always like that. He was, and I think you're seeing this a little bit now in San Francisco, where, I mean, he was the life behind that team that made the Super Bowl, right? As much as Kyle Shanahan was the schematic force, Robert Saleh was the culture and the energy and the rah-rah. And so I think the Jets caught that at the right time, and he's the right person for this organization that you have to be that way. I mean, we saw what Rex Ryan was able to do and kind of blow some life into this organization. I think that Robert Saleh is the same kind of guy, just a very different approach.
That's a great point, Connor, about what he brought to the 49ers. One thing we should touch on briefly was a very questionable lowering the helmet penalty on Bengals defender Mike Hilton. It didn't seem in line with the spirit of the rule. Obviously, any rule changes implemented to protect player safety are important and good and necessary. But in this instance, Mike Hilton seemed to go in to make the tackle. It looked like his target was going to be the torso of Ty Johnson, the running back. Looked like he was just going in for a pretty textbook tackle form. Ty Johnson then almost reflexively lowers his head to brace for the contact, but ends up basically dipping his head into Mike Hilton. It didn't seem like a very good call, and it was a third down play that, had they not made the call against the Bengals would have gotten the ball back. Now, there are a lot of different things that changed the outcome of the game. This was just one factor in the outcome of the game, but it is disappointing to see a questionable call have such an impact on the game and, you know, be something that's not reviewable.
It's disappointing for a couple reasons, right? Especially when you hate when, and I thought this about the body weight rule, lowering the helmet rule, when there are rules that are designed, you know, by the competition committee to increase the safety of the game and to keep players healthy, when it's overcalled or it's miscalled, I think it contributes to the cynicism that certain players, especially defensive players, have about the rules in the first place, and, you know, how the rules are already against them, and how, well, then if, you know, you're going to call it anyway, it doesn't matter how I hit you, you know. And so there is that attitude, right? There's that undercurrent. And when something like that happens, it is sort of disappointing, right? Because these rules, as much as everybody wants to roll their eyes and, you know, and shake their head at it and say, oh, it's ruining the game and all this stuff, it's designed with good in mind, right? I mean, there's no, you know, we don't, it's not like the NFL wants to turn everything into a 50-point game, although I guess I'm supposing that would be good for the brand. But I do think that there is a genuine concern after seeing generations of players come out of this thing not okay, that when you miscall something like that, then it just sort of balloons, and then the sarcasm and the cynicism just increases.
49ers, Bears.
All right, so Jimmy Garoppolo returns home to Chicago, and there are questions. Will the quarterback change happen now? I mean, we saw Trey Lance forced into duty earlier than expected because of an injury to Garoppolo, but Garoppolo's been back. Trey Lance was now healthy again. 49ers came into this game on a three-game losing streak, but the outcome is probably what the 49ers want. They won the game. Garoppolo played well enough to win the game. He passed for more than 300 yards, rushed for 2 touchdowns. He also provided a little extra push to the running back on a third one. So in the 49ers' view, you want to let Lance sit and learn as long as possible. But, you know, if Garoppolo's play doesn't allow you to do that, or his injury, whatever the case may be, then you put Lance in. But I think this is probably what the 49ers want at this point in the season, Connor.
Yeah, I was, you know, I think I had such high hopes after seeing Trey Lance in the preseason that I thought that, and especially that they put him in a goal line situation earlier in the year, that there would be more of this situational stuff and almost like a two quarterback offense. Kyle Shanahan said he was surprised that people thought that. I don't know. I thought that was kind of why you did it. And, you know, I thought that was sort of the spirit of the whole thing, was that you're not going to trade all this equity to just let this guy, you know, ice on the bench for a year. But that said, this was a good Jimmy Garoppolo performance, and you're going to get those from time to time. And I think those are the ones that you're like, okay, we can win with this guy. And he was great moving out of the pocket. He made some really nice kind of clutch throws there. And it's hard. I mean, you know, I still don't know what to make of this team. They're frustrating. I thought they might surprise some people and sneak back into the playoffs, but every year it just seems to be sort of the same story here. They're injured too much. It's just sort of this, and it turns into this middling sort of slog. But can they keep the momentum going after a win like this?
Yeah, and I had the same optimism for Lance as you did, Connor, but when we saw him push into duty earlier than expected because of Garoppolo's injury, I think it did become clear that he needs a little bit more time to learn and develop, and that's probably what they expected, although they did trade up a lot to get him to move up to pick number 3, so that raises the pressure and the expectations for him.
Yeah, and on the Bears front, I mean, oddly, I, at this point, I don't know if you're Matt Nagy, you probably have no positive takeaways because your back is sort of against the wall here and you probably needed Fields. You either probably wanted Dalton still in at this point or you needed Fields to be further along than he is. But one of his best games of the season, I would say, I mean, 175 yards and a touchdown, also performed well on the ground. But, you know, it's weird. It's like, you know, he's still a rookie. He's still holding on to the ball way too long. But I think he's got one of the longer snap-to-throw times in the NFL still. But, I mean, that pass to Jesse James on the rollout for the touchdown that actually put them ahead 10-3 earlier in the game was that sort of great next-level improvisational throw. That's the reason that you draft Justin Fields in the first place. But the thing that always troubles me and sort of grounds me in moments like that is I've said that 10 times a year about Mitch Trubisky, too. I mean, I would watch games and I would say he makes throws that situationally a lot of other quarterbacks can't make, but you maybe only get one or two of those a game. And I think, oddly, this is sort of the same kind of deal for Justin Fields right now. Now, is that indicative of the offense, right? Are they not being put in the right place? Are they not being made to feel more comfortable? I don't know, because they're still very conservative. Justin Fields, I don't think, connected on any deep passes and only attempted 2 of more than 20 yards today. So it's are on Sunday. And so it's interesting to see kind of what the dynamic is here. I mean, I don't know exactly what they're doing here, but if you're Matt Nagy, do you feel any pressure to sort of really punch the accelerator here? We've always thought and seen that the dynamic here is going to be strange, where if he doesn't develop the quarterback, is he going to go? Are they going to let somebody else develop the quarterback? And so I don't know. Is he coming along fast enough for the Bears at this point?
Yeah, I thought Fields' completion percentage, 70%, was good. As you mentioned, 100 yards on the ground. He obviously had that awesome touchdown run, which was another example, Connor, of why you draft him. It was 4th and 1. Looked like the play was totally over. There was nowhere for him to go. Eric Armstead is lunging at him, and he keeps the play alive, you know, drifts back the other way, ultimately weaves his way through the defense into the end zone. So that was one of those wow moments. I think it was his best performance, and I think it came in a good time because we saw him look totally discouraged last week against the Bucs. So if you're looking for a rookie quarterback week to week, you want to see them bounce back after a game like last week's. And I thought there were signs that Fields did this. Of course, it was still a loss. And, you know, it's interesting that his best performance so far was a game in which Matt Nagy wasn't there and wasn't calling the plays. He's sidelined with COVID-19, right? So what does that mean for the bigger picture? I mean, this Bears organization has a lot to figure out. At least you can grasp onto those highlight plays from Fields. And at this point, you're probably thinking to yourself, you hope that the next regime can get the most out of those little glints that you see.
Yeah, and with Gary not here to defend Matt Nagy, as he's one to do, I think it's great. You know, you can just we can save listeners' time and you know, our own time, just sort of move on to the next game.
Dolphins Bills.
All right, this game was just kind of a blah game. I don't think the Bills look particularly good, although they did pull away in the second half. I mean, it's tied 3-3 at halftime. Bills still haven't beaten a team with a winning record, which I think is an interesting stat. You know, should make for some good Patriots-Bills matchups down the line, Connor. As for the Dolphins, here to me is the most stunning stat. They are 1-7 right now, which is the same record they had at this point of the 2019 tanking season.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, and it's so weird because I've been more convinced that other coaches were going to be great coaches. I think you and I are still, I don't know, are we still on lockstep that Brian Flores is a good coach? I think Brian Flores is a very good coach.
I still have a lot of respect for Brian Flores as a coach, Connor, but I think the way he handled the situation with Tua Tagovailoa, you know, basically making him constantly look over his shoulder, answer questions week to week about a potential replacement that the team may be trading for, they didn't put him in a situation to succeed this season. And, you know, maybe you're looking for other options at the position, okay, but there just seemed like a lot more the organization could be doing to support Tagovailoa's development. And I feel like a lot of the public comments have only hurt that.
Yeah. And it's been strange, right? I mean, I think that each version, each iteration of the offensive coordinator change, so you've changed offensive coordinators now three times under Tagovailoa, but a lot of the offensive coordinators have had the same sort of central theory, like, right, and even if it's what you have now, which is sort of a version of the Patriots offense, or what you had before with Chan Gailey, I get the point, right? You're trying to capitalize on Tua's short to medium range accuracy, and so you're going to do a lot of stuff like that. But I think, you know, with Tua at the NFL level, I think that you have to have a little bit more imagination. I think that you have to allow him to maybe do some more stuff off schedule, because right now it looks like when plays break down, he's just not comfortable, which is odd for a player with that much arm talent and that much mobility. And it just looks like when things aren't going the way that he's designed to go, that's when he makes kind of that boneheaded interception. That's when he throws the ball does something he's not supposed to do. So I don't know. Like, I don't know if I've said, and I got in trouble for this. I got yelled at for this on Twitter, but I think that Brian Flores' greatest failing is just an inability to find a creative partner for Tua. I think that's as much your job as anything, and you're a defensive head coach, so your job is to scan your Rolodex, right, and find somebody. I don't care where he's from, you know, or what level of football he coaches at. Your job is to find his guy, his schematic sort of muse, and he has not been able to do that yet.
Yeah, that is always the biggest challenge for the defensive head coach. If you make the right pick and the offensive coordinator is a big success, then they generally are plucked and hired away after like a year. Or you don't pick the right guy and then you rotate through and it ultimately undercuts all the good things you can do as a coach because you don't have the right offensive play caller. So I definitely think that's a difficult situation right now for the Dolphins. But the upshot here is that they're the biggest disappointment, I would say, in 2021. I mean, they're not the worst team in the NFL, but they're the biggest disappointment because we saw a 10-win team last year that seemed like, oh, they're ahead of schedule on the rebuild. This is all going the right direction. And for them to be at this point in the season where they were halfway through the 2019 rebuild, which was the year that they were tearing everything down, is just, completely the opposite direction, obviously, and compared to the optimism of last season is, you know, really a big contrast. All right, Connor, now it's time for the lightning round. And I have to say, if there was ever a week to have a lightning round, this is a good week. There were a lot of blowouts, a lot of very uninteresting games against teams that have among the worst rosters in the NFL, or the worst rosters in the NFL. So we're going to breeze through some of these, but let's start with Panthers Falcons. Darnold played a little bit better this week, but ultimately leaves the game with a concussion. We saw Stephon Gilmore make his Panthers debut and picked up right where he left off, game clinching interception. So, you know, any thoughts on this game?
Well, I just think, you know, it continues to be a situation where if you're the Falcons, you know, can you be sure? You can never be sure of anything in this world, right? But if you're the Falcons, where are you going? But if you're the Panthers, you know, what's the deal here with Sam Darnold? I mean, 13 of 24, 129 yards, and then, you know, leaves the game with a concussion. But it's just the star fall here has been stark, you've already said that you're out, rightfully so, wisely so, on the Deshaun Watson front. And so you know, you passed up the chance to take Justin Fields, and now you're sort of left in this position where, I mean, it's awful late to do something, and it looks like, you know, if Sean Payton goes and nabs Cam Newton, you're really out of options here.
Yeah, I mean, the Panthers are clearly a team that's still in search of a franchise quarterback. You have been on this all along, not really understanding the swap of Teddy Bridgewater for Sam Darnold. And because of the law of averages, Connor, everything is evened out. And Sam Darnold has proved to be the quarterback that we pretty much thought he was entering the season. Not the long-term answer, but get through another week.
Yeah, and a good, a nice little warm call out to our editor, Gary Gramling, here by bringing up the law of averages.
Yeah, you know, always got to keep our people in mind.
Washington Broncos.
All right, so this game had a little bit of a suspenseful end, more suspenseful than you would have expected. The Broncos had a chance to kneel out the clock, but Melvin Gordon fumbles, so Washington gets the ball back for one last gasp. Ultimately, doesn't work out. The Broncos win this 17-10, and one of the unfortunate things that came out of this game is the continued fulfillment of the prophecy of the kicker with a very unfortunate name, Chris Blewett. And he now has 3 blocked field goal attempts in his first 5 tries as Washington's kicker, including 2 today, which is like sort of hard to imagine. Perhaps there's something in the operation that opposing teams are seeing, or maybe it's just bad luck, but really unfortunate because, you know, of the name and all of the headlines that it could lead to.
It takes a lot of fortitude to kick in the NFL. It takes a lot more fortitude to kick in the NFL when your last name is Blewett.
Yeah.
You know, that's just a difficult situation. But interesting win here for the Broncos. I think that you stay afloat a little bit. I think that this was a team that I thought might sneak into that second wild card. And while the Raiders have sort of occupied that space largely in the AFC West, I think that they're fighting, right? And I think that's all you want when, you know, this team had some super high expectations going into the year. They're always going to try to punch you out this way. They're going to try to win 17-10 games, you know, 19-13 games, stuff like that. But, you know, so this was kind of their day, and just another disappointing performance from this Washington football team defense that we thought, if you're facing an offense like the Broncos, this is where you would shine, right? This is where you would punish a quarterback like Teddy Bridgewater, who, while super efficient this year, has, you know, kind of been a, you know, maybe a 15th best quarterback, you know, 12th, 15th best quarterback in the NFL. But, you know, weren't able to get that done.
Yeah. And really interesting situation with the AFC West right now. I mean, the standings, everyone's just jammed in there. You've got the Raiders at 5-2, Chargers at 4-3, Broncos at 4-4, and Chiefs at 3-4 heading into Monday night against the Giants. So really a wide open division.
Jaguars, Seahawks.
All right, Connor. So we have Geno Smith's first win as a starter after close losses to the Steelers and the Saints. This was a runaway win against the Jaguars, 31-7. It was a shutout until the final minutes. The Jaguars score and then attempt an onside kick, which the Seahawks actually returned for a touchdown. So a pretty stunning turn of events here. And, you know, the Seahawks get a win with Russell Wilson out. That's a good thing for them. And the Jaguars just continue to look lost with Urban Meyer as head coach.
Here is my consistent, constant plea. Again, I mean, Trevor Lawrence, 32-54, 238, 1 touchdown, 1 interception. Of course, if you're a rookie quarterback, you're going to have games that aren't phenomenal. But to Gary's point, you know, this could have been an Andrew Luck season, right? I think the talent there is comparable, and he is that good, you know, and I think that I don't think Dave Caldwell left the roster as threadbare as a lot of people want to say he did in Jacksonville. I think this team could have been good enough. They're certainly better than what they've been putting on the field. I'm just hoping that the Jaguars do not give Urban Meyer full authority to gut this roster at the trade deadline. I think that would be a horrendous thing. I don't think he's shown, outside of Trevor Lawrence, any aptitude to handle these picks well, although it's sort of a short sample size right now. I really hope they don't let him gut this roster at the trade deadline. I think that would be, you know, giving him more power, moving him even higher up the food chain here. in Jacksonville when I think the answer is probably to cut bait at the end of the season is, you know, it's a tough situation.
Well, if Gary were here, you would also mention all of Trevor Lawrence's lost reps in training camp to Gardner Minshew. So we will do him a solid and reference that as well, which continues to be true.
Yes.
Rams, Texans.
Okay, speaking of threadbare rosters, we have an incredible mismatch here between the Rams and the Texans. Really, these last two games, Connor, could be lumped together. They were both runaway blowouts that you could lose interest in by the end of the third quarter. In this one, to the Texans' credit, they kept things a little interesting with a flurry of scoring in the fourth quarter. So it's 38-0 on the Texans managed to score 22 points in the fourth quarter, notably in part because of recovering an onside kick. This is now the second straight week in which the Rams' onside kick coverage has not gone well. And again, I know that this will irk Gary because of the law of averages and small sample size. He hates small sample sizes. But I am certain that the Rams will be spending extra time in practice working on their onside kick coverage after the last 2 weeks.
No doubt. That's why you don't let Bones Fossil go to Dallas.
Yes.
He's a legend like that. You give up some, you give up a little bit of, get up a little bit of heat on the onside kick front. But I was thinking about this today, and, you know, we had a couple lopsided scores here, but really it's one of the first times that it almost resembles college in that, you know, there are just so many severe talent discrepancy mismatches this year. And whether it's talent discrepancy or maybe on the Jacksonville front, like we just said in the last thing, coaching discrepancy, preparation discrepancy, whatever it is, mm-hmm. like there are some of these weird games that you look at almost like you look at when Alabama plays North Carolina A&T or something like that. Like it's like a game you don't even consider before it starts. And I don't remember I get to say this now. You know, I like kind of saying this in my 11 years of covering the NFL that, you know, I don't really remember that sort of like game that you would walk into it and say, okay, I know pretty much exactly what's going to happen now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's really interesting because they're not necessarily teams that have tried to undergo a tanking gutting process. They're just teams that, for a variety of reasons, the talent has just become incredibly bare.
Eagles, Lions.
All right. Speaking yet again of another threadbare roster, the Lions. I actually thought they had a chance in this game because the Lions have been pretty feisty. I've liked the way that Dan Campbell has handled things. They played a really good game against the Rams last week. Now, I'm sure part of that was it was an emotional game with Jared Goff playing his old team, et cetera, et cetera. But he's had the team ready to play. And I thought the Eagles are a far inferior opponent than the Rams, but this one was also over very early on. Eagles just ran away with this. And it was one of those demoralizing performances with the Lions that left me wondering, well, will they win a game this season? And, you know, if they don't, what does that mean for building moving forward, as I referenced earlier, the positive reinforcement loop? You like to have some positive reinforcement. You know, I've talked to players about avoiding the stain of a winless season, looking ahead at their schedule. You know, there's a Thanksgiving game against the Bears, maybe week 18 against the Packers, if the Packers don't have anything to play for at that point. But games like this make you wonder, you know, if they'll be able to win one.
God bless Dan Campbell, who after the game said that of one of the linebackers that played well, I noticed him in the sea of trash we were floating in today. So just a wonderful, fairly apt description of what we saw in there. And it's disappointing because there was so much feistiness from this Lions team. There was so much fight. And then to get throttled like this with the Eagles, and who knows, like there have been, and I'm sure that you've heard the same thing from coaches, Jenny, where maybe you're an offensive coordinator or a defensive coordinator, and you just pick up on the right thing. You just pull the right thread on a Sunday, and everything comes unraveled because the other team isn't prepared to stop it. I think we saw that a couple weeks ago with the Patriots and the Jets. Then the Jets came back and had a big win. I think we see that this week, too, with the Lions and the Eagles. But I will give a special shout out to just in this game, afterwards, Lane Johnson was talking to reporters, really opened up about his mental health condition, what he's been going through, and said at the end there that the real reason or the real message here for other people is just don't ever bottle it up. It's not easy to do that. The bad news is that I think a lot more people have it than what meets the eye. It's easy to put on a poker face. He remembers saying that someone told him at the combine about 50% of players in the NFL have some sort of mental health condition. And so he said to be open about that. So kudos to Lane Johnson. I think that's a difficult thing to talk about. So I appreciate him doing that.
Yeah, that's some important and needed honesty by Lane Johnson there. You know, Connor, I think it's a good note to end on. And also the idea that no matter what your circumstances, you could be existing in a sea of trash. Try to be that linebacker who played well. Inspiration for all of us. I want to take that into this week. Be a bright spot in the sea of trash.
As two people who used to run a podcast, and we named it the Weekside Podcast, I really could identify with the sea of trash, you know? And so I felt really good about that. I loved hearing, you know, God, if he's got a future in broadcasting if he wants to do that afterwards. So God bless Dan Campbell. Here's to hoping many more years of press conferences.
Well, there's everybody's Monday motivation. Thanks for joining this Halloween episode of the Monday Morning Podcast, and we will be back later this week. The MMQB Monday Morning Podcast is me, Jenny Rentis, Connor Orr, and Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Thanks, as always, to senior podcast producer Dan Bloom for his show notes every week. Mark Moravik is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, leave a rating and review, because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you find your podcasts.